Welcome. This is the second half of a class we started before Passover. So I'm going to review because it was a while ago and because there are some people who weren't there. But I'll give a very fast review of the first half. So basically, we're talking about sexuality, the Jewish view of sexuality, and what that is and how we arrive at that understanding and how it's so different. So we started out by talking about the goal of marital intimacy being the euphemism for sex. Right, but it really is actually marital intimacy that we're talking about, not sex altogether, but sex within marriage. So the goal not being just procreation, but being pleasure, being connection, and also procreation, but it actually is an obligation even outside of procreation, and it actually is an obligation. So we'll look at that. We talked about circumcision, bris milah, and how it's a process of cutting away and also revealing, so that there's really three steps in the actual circumcision, but there's a cutting away, a revelation, and the withdrawing of blood. So we cut, that's to represent that we cut away, we step back from the whole rest of the world in our view of sexuality, and that is actually the foundation of our ability to control ourselves and maintain the relationship that we have with God and all the different mitzvahs that we have, is the ability to step away and not be them. But we also have to know not just who we aren't, but who we are, so we have to step forward to what we actually are. That's what this class is about. We're not Christian, we don't think that sexuality is bad. We talked about a continuum of physical and spiritual and how many religions try to figure out, well, if we're both physical and spiritual, so and we realize that we have souls, so our raison d'etre must be spiritual, so then how do we work with the physical? Many religions see it as a continuum, physical on one side, spiritual on the other, and that the further you distance yourself from the physical, the closer you get to spiritual. And so there's a lot of distancing, including celibacy in many religions, not in Judaism. We see not a continuum, but rather the physical as the vehicle for the spiritual. And so the physical has to be used in order to accomplish the spiritual. Let's see. So we talked about the purpose of creation, which is pleasure. You're here to get pleasure. And the question is, how do you get the most pleasure? What good is, God wants to give good. As an axiom, God is good, God wants to give good. How will God give the best good? So we talked about the fact that God is good and God is the best of all goods. There's nothing better than God. And the way that God wants to give God's self, or the mechanism for giving oneself, is through relationships. Relationships are the way that you can give yourself to another. To the extent of the strength of your relationship, that's how you give yourself to another. So that's why we were created in the image of God, because we want to have as strong a relationship as possible. So we're created in God's image so that we could be similar to God, so that we could be in a relationship with God, and through that relationship, receive God. But we weren't created complete. We were created just starting off. And it's our job to emulate God in our lives, to make ourselves more God-like through our behavior. The more God-like we become, the stronger relationship we can be in. The stronger relationship we're in, the more God we can receive, which means the more pleasure we get. And in the end, that fulfills the purpose of creation. And we looked at these two texts, creation of mankind and creation of woman. And we talked about how God let us make man in our image and after our likeness. So we talked about that. God created man in his own image, male and female. He created them. So we talked about how the first Adam creature was a dual-gendered being, had two faces. And when one walked forward, it meant the other one walked backwards because it was connected at the back with two faces, one on each side. But it was one whole being. Everything else, all the other animals are created in pairs. Just human beings are created as one, because being created in God's image means being created as one, because God is one. So, and in addition to other things that are God's image, the fact that God can give and that God creates and that God has free will. But then we read the next set, the next verses, and it says it's not good that the Adam should be alone, and we talked about why that's not good. A, Rashi says there's an ego problem, that the Adam might see himself like God. God rules the heavens, and he might say, God's the unique guy who rules the heavens, I'm the unique guy who rules the earth, we're two unique guys. So in order to solve the ego problem, woman was made, and we said that that's actually a textual proof that there was total co-equality between male and female, because if woman solved the problem, the ego problem, which is what the text says, solved that problem, then she must be 100% co-equal. Otherwise, the ego problem wouldn't be solved, because it could be that Adam could say, God is the unique guy in heavens with his servants. I'm the unique guy on earth with my servants. We're two unique guys with our servants. So a woman has to be co-equal. That was number one. Number two is, not good for man to be alone. Not good because he can't actualize himself. Who will he give to? In order to become godlike, he has to be able to give. And if, let's say there was asexual reproduction of this whole creature, you'd have the whole earth populated by whole creatures, and nobody would be able to give because everybody has everything. So we need to be missing parts. So in order to create a situation in which we could give meaningfully to each other and thereby actualize our godly selves and become more godlike, so then God separated out the female from this androgynous being. So, but we said, and we left off right in the middle of this text, because there's quite a few strange things in this text. So he said that God identified the problem, not good for Adam to be alone, identified the solution, I'm going to create a helpmate for him. And then we said the next thing that should happen should be what? Should carry out the solution, right? Bless you. Right? So that should be the next thing. But instead, what happens? Instead, we have this whole strange... You have the text right there. Instead, we have this whole strange thing where God brings all the animals of the earth. It's verse, I think, 19, out of the ground. So, right, not good for the man to be alone. I'll make him a helpmate to match him. That's verse 18. Right? And really, it should skip right down to verse 21. But it doesn't. You have 19 and 20. That says, out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle and to the birds of the air and every beast of the field. But for the man, there was not found a help to match him. So that's strange, because God said he's going to make him a helper, not introduce him to everybody on the planet and see if he can find a mate, right? So we have to ask what's going on here with that. And then I think we did talk about the naming process. I think that's where we left off, is right after that. So the naming process, we discussed that names in Hebrew the word name is shame, and there is sham. So we know that when we have the same word with different vowels, they're connected to each other. I think we talked about the hub and spoke concept. Does that ring a bell? That Jewish words, Hebrew words, are like a hub, right? So you just take the root, and that's like the hub. And then every way that root manifests is like a spoke. So it's all connected. So let's say you have, let's just say, petach, right? Petach is an opening. So you have pe, taf, chet, right? That's, and so the root means opening. But it can manifest as poteach, open up, as a verb, or mafteach, a key, right? Or lifateach, to develop, right? It's all the same word, but it has different spokes, different manifestations of the same root. So when we have the same root, the words are connected somehow. We have to see how they're connected. So shame means name, sham means there. A shame says what is there, right? We understand that parents name sometimes with Ruach HaKodesh, that's where we have the Holy Spirit left over in each one of us. When we give a child a name, we actually are accessing a divine energy to give the right name to that neshama in that child. The Hebrew name is a Ruach HaKodesh name. So what's going on here? He is naming all the creatures. So I don't remember if we said what the Midrash was or not. I think I left you right there in that spot. But I did explain, right, that the Hebrew letters are about giving the name, right? And that actually the Hebrew letters, just to review that also, that the way Hebrew words work is, it's not just Ruach HaKodesh, but each letter actually says what the thing is. If you understand how the Hebrew letters work, it's like the periodic table of elements, that you can put together the different letters and it makes the actual word, and it actually says what it is, not just a convention. It's not like water or agua. It's actually H2O. It describes what it is, not just we agree that's the name for it. Okay, so the Midrash says, what is going on here? What is this passage? Why is it here? Remember we said that any strange passage in a text is like a red flag saying, dig here, there's treasure. So the Midrash says, what is the treasure buried here? So the Midrash tells a very strange story. I didn't tell you the story. Okay, so I'm just reminding you that Midrash is not taken literally. There's something true in the story, but it doesn't mean the story is true. Okay, that's important to know. The Midrash says that in order to name all the creatures, he had to get to know all the creatures.
Oh, yeah.
I did tell you that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, I did. Yes, that's a little odd, right? He had to get to know all the creatures. Right? So, getting to know is the biblical getting to know. So that's where I left you off, is what is getting to know? What is knowledge? Why do we use that word? So I'm going to take you to the second sheet for a second before I answer the question. And we're going to talk about knowledge. Three of the words that we use for knowledge are chachma, bina, and da. We did not talk about this last week, right?
We did.
Oh, I did talk. Okay, excellent. Okay, good. So we talked about chachma, bina, and dat, and the dat means connection. So I gave you the driving analogy, right?
Right.
About learning how to drive, and the book is the chachma, the book knowledge, when you get the rules, and bina is understanding the information within the context, and dat is when you actually know the information so much that your body knows it. You're totally connected with the information. It's not in your head anymore. It's part of how you work, right? So you actually have the body feel for it. That's when it's dot, when it's totally integrated into you. That's dot, total connection with the information. So that's why the Torah says, and he knew her, that's total connection with the information. So getting to know somebody biblically is not a euphemism. It's actually creating that deep level of connection with the concepts that are there, with the other person, or with the information. That's what dat is. So he got to know all the creatures in order to be able to name them. He had to understand them in order to be able to give them a name. But through getting to know every creature, he realized there is no mate for me here. That's a whole strange question, too. Why did God actually give him this experiential learning device? And we can see that with marriage, anybody who's been married or who is married knows that's not the easiest journey. It's a worthwhile journey, but it's not an easy one. And it sometimes helps to know that there is no nobody else could be your mate. There is nobody else on the planet. That's actually one of the blessings that we give in the seven blessings under the chuppah. These mates should be like in Eden, right? So not just it should be like the Garden of Eden in your home. What was in the Garden of Eden? One man and one woman. That's it. There was nobody else. Neither one of the members of those couple could say, I think he would have made a much better husband for me. And she's such a nice wife. Wouldn't she be a better wife for me? You can't say that in the Garden of Eden, where there's just one plus one. That's it. So under the chuppah, we bless that your marriage should be like the marriage in Eden, where all you have eyes for is each other. And you know 100% that that is the one for you. And nobody else could do the job. So he first gets that experiential. Nobody else could be the mate that he needs. Now he realizes it, and now it's time to make the mate. So what happens? God puts him to sleep, causes a deep sleep upon the man, upon Adam, and he slept, and as he slept, he took one of his sides and closed up the flesh in its place. And of the side which the Lord God had taken from the man, he made a woman and brought her to the man. And then the man said, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called Isha, because she was taken out of Ish. The language is connected. So now we have this strange thing. So what is the rib, or the side, whatever it is? So the side, if you think about it, what is the side? The side is something that's hidden, even if you're not clothed. It's not something that you can see. So it is a hidden part here, the rib. But, and its function is what? What is the function of the rib?
Structure.
Protection. Right. It protects the inner, and it gives structure and form to the body, and it's hidden. So that's really what was taken out of this androgynous whole being, was that element that gives form and structure and protects the innerness. So really, the innerness was taken out of the whole thing. So what happened was there was this whole being. God put the whole being to sleep, so to speak, didn't exactly work this way, reached inside, pulled out the innerness, and made that into woman, and the outerness into man. And if you think about the shape of men and women, their shape is the same, except for their gender organs, a man's being on the outside, and a woman's being on the inside. So they really do, and that's where they connect from outside to inside. And if you think about traditional roles, so traditional roles are a man going out and a woman nurturing in. And just parenthetically, even though I am a daughter of the, not exactly of the sexual revolution, but daughter of the sexual revolution, daughter of feminism for sure. It's interesting to see what's happened to our country in the last 40 years as feminism has really become de rigueur, right? So a woman is as good as a man because a woman can be a man as well as a man can be. That's basically what we've taught ourselves. Rather than a woman as good as a man because being feminine is just as good as being masculine. So what we've done in a way, we don't have a word for this, but we've emasculated, we've effeminated our women in a way and effeminated our society so that we don't really have anybody nurturing the innerness anymore to a great extent. And we have so much outerness and so much of the feminine energy is going out rather than nurturing in. And that's where we see not just Jewish families, we see Jewish families, we see non-Jewish families, we see societies, we see communities kind of falling apart at the edges because that feminine energy is not keeping, it's not protecting the innerness. That's not where we're headed. Just something to think about what has happened as we have gone out. I'm not saying that women shouldn't go out and work and do and accomplish, but it has been at the expense of our innerness, personal innerness, personal relationships, think about friendships. But my official job, teaching is my love and passion, but my official job is coaching young Rebbetzins in the field. So young Rebbetzins who are newly parts of congregations or teachers or whatever they are, so my job is to fly around, meet with them, and help them blossom into who they can be. One of the key problems I see is loneliness. In the 20 sets, they don't have friends. They can't. They do have friends from seminary. They're all separated from them. They don't know how to make friends in their community because nobody has time. Nobody has time for friendships. So anybody in this room, I think all of us are 40-ish and older, right? So I'm just looking around. So if you're under 40, sorry. But I'd say anybody 40 and older raised children or had children with some time. But today's 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds are having children without time. They don't even stand at the bus stop anymore together because the bus comes to the house or they drive their kids to school. So there's not even that 10 minutes every day where you stand next to somebody who might not be your friend but becomes a friend because 10 minutes every single day. The only way you can make a friendship is by spending time. And there's just not time to create that kind of friendship. So there's more stress on marriages because you expect your spouse to be your friend. You don't have other friends. And it's just the whole thing. It's a whole chain reaction of what it is to have so much time being spent out of the house. Anyway, back to this. Just thinking about that. Something just to contemplate. What are the effects of all that stuff, right? I saw a KitchenAid commercial print ad with KitchenAid appliances all over the kitchen and a woman leaning on the counter saying, "In my house, the housekeeper is anyone who's home at the time. The homemaker. In my house, the homemaker is anyone who's home at the time." And how great, she has all these appliances that she doesn't even need to be home. That was the message, right? Right. Right. So the concept, because people are conflating homemaker with dish doer, clothes launderer, not creator of home, right? And creator of family. Anyway, so that is where the woman was created from the rib, so it's the innerness. And there is this concept of innerness and outerness, the masculine energy and the feminine energy, and how they work together. It's interesting to think about, you know, the seven circles under the chuppah. I'm sure you've all seen that tradition, right? So what is going on there? Anybody know?
Is it for each day of the week?
What part?
The walking around.
Yeah, right, walking around, but each day of the week what? You just walk around one day of the week? One circle for each day of the week. Why?
So that every single day is a blessed day.
Okay, that could be. Yeah.
Doesn't it also symbolize the home or the circle?
So the chuppah symbolizes the home that's open, yeah. Right? But what's happening is the woman is circling the man, mm-hmm. because the Talmud says, "Ishto keveto," his wife is like his home. His wife is his home. Actually, physically, he lives inside her, right? So she is his home. So when she circles around him, it's also a sexual image, right? She's saying, "I create the environment. I commit to create the environment in which you will live. It's my responsibility to be the creator of environment." And I create environments like God does through the seven spherot, the seven energetic planes that God created this world through. That's what she takes on, seven circles around. She is the creator, just like God, co-creator. We are created in the image of God, so we're empowered with creation. Right? So this is a place where the woman takes on her role of creating the environment, because as a girl, she's not the environment creator. But as the wife, she is the environment creator. And that's where she says, I will create the environment in which this couplehood, it's not about chaining him or encircling him, although it's interesting to think about, the letter Samech, which is a circle, is a feminine letter, whatever that means. I don't know all the Kabbalah of all the letters, but I know that Samech is a feminine letter. So Samech is a circle. So that can be the hug of nurturing, but that can also be smothering, right? Depending on the same circle can be nurturing and smothering, right? So that's why they have jokes about Jewish mothers. I don't know if you've heard, you know, the difference between a Jewish mother and a Rottweiler. You know the difference?
What's the answer?
The difference between a Jewish mother and a Rottweiler. Eventually the dog will release the child. So as Jewish moms, we are particularly attached to our children. And it's a trick to learn how to open up, right? And give our children wing. I was thinking about the other day, as I was saying, Poteach et yedecha u'masbi'a l'chol charetzon. Open up your hand, God, and satisfy the needs of every living thing. So because I come from a quasi-Sephardic background, so I actually, the Sephardim open up their hand when they say it. There's the physical motion. So I was davening for guidance with a particular child who was giving me a rough time. And another way to hear that verse is open up your hand and give every living thing desire. Not satisfy the desire of every living thing, but umasbi'a l'chol chai ratzon, give desire to every living thing. And I was like not feeling so desirous of helping this child out. So I was saying, please Hashem, give me the desire that I need to keep on plugging away with this child. But I opened up my hand and I realized, oh, it's open up your hand to give us desire. Hashem, we want Hashem to give us our desire with an open hand, not with strings attached, right? With an open hand. And I realized that I'm asking God to give me an open hand, but I'm not treating her with an open hand. And I needed to just open more and let go of some of the strings to be the parent that emulated God in parenting for an older teen, not for a little kid. Anyway, something to think
how
about.
Yeah. Did I come to you? How'd that work out?
Yeah. It's still working. but it's worked out for the older ones so far. So working on launching.
Good request.
Working on the launching. Yeah.
Is Sefer from Sphera? Is it the
yes.
same? So that's interesting.
Right.
That's
so if you think about the hub.
Right.
Think about the hub, right? So you have the Samech Pei Fe of Sefer, which means
Sefer.
Book, or Sipur, which means story, or Mispar, which means number. So a story, a book, a number, and also sphere, right? An environment, and the sphere root, it's the same exact root of the energetic fields through which God creates things. They're all delineations of something. Right? That's what a number is. It's a delineation of something. A book is a story inside a cover, right? And a story is a beginning and an end. It's a piece of something. It's all a delineation. So mispar, safar, misparayim is scissors. It cuts mm-hmm. things. It delineates. So you can see how that hub of that root and all the different spokes, there's all different manifestations of delineation in there. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Once you start to learn Hebrew, Hebrew is hugely faith-building. Because the more I see how Hebrew words connect to each other, the more I just see that it's impossible there could be anything as intricate as this, where there's so many different manifestations.
Just the word shoresh.
Yeah, to me.
It means root.
Right,
so
right.
Obviously everything grows from the root.
Right.
So it's very interesting.
Right. Okay, so now we have the woman brought to the man. He recognizes her, says, oh, now I get it. I've tried out everybody else. I see you. Obviously, you are my mate. You shall be called woman because you're taken from man. And now we have this last verse. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. What is going on here? It's a strange thing. Right? So what happens? First, they're created as one, then divided in two, And now the whole job is to get back to being one. It's a little schizophrenic in a way, right? Do you want one or two, right? So you create one in the image of God. And I think we said also that the soul in Shemayim is also created as one. Right? Did I explain that? So it says in the Gemara Anita that the soul too, so the body was created as one, and also the soul is created as one. And then the soul is torn in half, so to speak, half sent into a male body, half sent into a female body, and then hopefully about 20 years later, you find each other, you find your soulmate, right? There is one exact soulmate. There are many Besherts, many, many Besherts.
Could you explain the difference?
So I'm going to use an analogy, and I just want you to know that souls are far more complicated than I'm explaining right now. So for another class, I could mix you up about souls further. This is layer one of souls, okay? So in layer one of understanding souls, just imagine a nice, round, healthy soul, torn in half, right? After it's torn in half, there's jagged edges. Those jagged edges match perfectly with the other side, right? Because that if it's from that one that it was torn. That's the soulmate, those two that match perfectly. Now, there's a lot of other jagged edges that will match very nicely, but not perfectly, but very, very nicely. Because when you tear, again, this is just a parable, right? When you tear that in half, there's a lot of other sets of jagged edges that will be a very nice match. That's a Beshert, is somebody who will be a very nice match. Not a perfect match, but a very nice match. Under the chuppah, actually, if you marry a Beshert and not your soulmate, there is a spiritual transconfiguration that happens under first wedding chuppahs, where the jagged edges are reconfigured so that they will match perfectly. There's not the bonding under the chuppah. There's just the reconfiguration that they could match perfectly. The bonding is what the whole marriage is about, knitting the two soul halves together. That's what we're trying to do. You shall become one flesh. So you are now broken in two, but the whole job is to become one again because we're supposed to emulate God, right? So we couldn't be one because we can't give like God. So we need it to be two so that we'll both be missing parts so that we can give to each other meaningfully. And yet as two, we can't emulate God because God is one. So we have to get back to being one so that we can be givers and be one, right? We want ultimate God emulation. So, moving on to the next page. Okay, so what is a mitzvah? What's the definition for mitzvah? Did we discuss that last time? So there's lots of different words. I'm sure you know some. Just throw them out.
A good deed.
A good deed, a commandment.
Obligation.
Okay, so the word technically means commandment. A lot of people translate it as good deed. Good deed covers a lot of mitzvahs, but not all of them. For instance, putting on tefillin. Is that a good deed? Like, who does that help? It's not really. Giving tzedakah is being kind to somebody, cooking for somebody, making a nice meal, whatever it is. Those are good deeds. But putting on tefillin or a talis or kissing a mezuzah, oh, that's not a mitzvah, putting up a mezuzah, those aren't good deeds, really. So it could be that these are deeds that are good to do. It could be a good deed that way. Or it could be a commandment, and they are obligatory, so that works also. In Aramaic, the root of mitzvah, we do actually go a little bit back and forth between Hebrew and Aramaic to learn different things in the languages. They are related. The root in Aramaic, the same root for mitzvah, means another manifestation is pliers. Pliers brings together two far apart ends. That's the job of a pliers, is to squeeze something together, right? So a mitzvah connects. So it's a connector. It connects two far apart ends. What does a mitzvah connect?
You to God.
Connects you to God, but it connects something else.
You to another person?
You to yourself, actually. Because it has to be something that fits every single mitzvah, all 613. Right? Some of the mitzvahs are about offering sacrifices. Some of the mitzvahs are about checking animals for kashrut. Some of the mitzvahs are about going to the mikvah, right? So each mitzvah has to connect somehow. So here is my definition for mitzvah. A mitzvah is a physical pathway that leads to a spiritual result. It connects the physical and the spiritual, right? Because we said we're not like the other religions that see physical and spiritual on a continuum. It's not that the more that you distance yourself from the physical, you attain spirituality, but we are physical and we are spiritual, so we have to figure out, why are we in a body? How do we use the physical? Right? We're a soul before we're born, and we're a soul after we die. Right? So the soul's created, comes into the body, wears the body for 90 years, 120 years, then sheds the body, and it's still a soul. So what's the point of the body? Why are we here? Right? So we talked about the purpose of all creation is pleasure, but what's the purpose of here? What do you think?
To correct some problems that you've had in past lives or...
Okay, what about the first life? Were there problems in the first life?
I assume that there's problems in every life.
No, but I'm saying you're born. The first time you're born. We do believe in reincarnation. Mm-hmm. But the first time you're born of problems?
I have no idea.
So we all know we're supposed to be doing something, right? And we all know that concept of fixing, we are supposed to fix. But what are we fixing, really? So we do have concepts of fixing, and we do have reincarnation. Reincarnation is not seen as a great thing. It's actually considered pretty uncomfortable, physically and spiritually uncomfortable. So reincarnation is only for people who have done enough that they deserve to come back, but not enough that they need to come back. Right? They've done enough that they deserve to come back. So they've generated merit, and they deserve a second chance. But they need a second chance because they didn't actually do enough. Right? So somebody who did a lot of bad stuff doesn't get to come back. They're done. Right? They blew it. Somebody who did, you know, who's...
What happens to them?
There is soul destruction for people who are all bad. So, I mean, for people who are majority bad, let's say, I don't know, 70 and above percent bad, their soul is destroyed. Again, that's just a number. It's not exact. God figures it out, right? And then people who have only good can exist in the eternal world. Only good. So whatever we create, whatever connections we create, good connections, are what we live in the next world. Any bad has to be excised. So if you can excise the bad and be left over with some good, that can live forever.
So, excise the bad about yourself.
About yourself. But you're not born bad. So the question is, what are we here for? So we're here to transform ourselves. Transformation. That's what we're here for. We come into the world basically a blob. Right? So we come in a baby, but a baby can't do anything for itself, can't give. It comes in with its fists closed, right? Taking only. Right? But hopefully you leave the world as somebody much more developed than you came in. Now, some people leave the same way. They do. Some people come in and they leave just pretty much selfish, not nice takers. And so they really haven't accomplished anything. But hopefully all of us are going to work on trying to transform ourselves, become like God, so that we can be in that relationship in the forever. Right? That's what Olam Haba is. Did I tell you my Olam Haba mashal, my story? At all about that? Yeah.
You know, you're saying this, but what about, like, you're in the world, but also you're learning from your parents or from somebody else, too, so your job just, you're learning and then you teach.
Right. So why are you teaching? Why are you learning? What's the point of that?
Well, the teacher, the mother, or the father, or the elder, is trying to teach you to learn things, to be good, to do things the right way, and that's when you're learning, and then when you kind of get older, you're trying to give them the steps.
Right, but why? Just so that you could, that's like the question of why marry Jewish. You should marry Jewish so you can give birth to Jews, so you can raise Jews, so they should marry Jewish, so they can give birth to Jews and raise Jews and marry Jewish. Is that it?
No.
We're marrying Jewish just for continuity? We're teaching this just for continuity? There's got to be a reason that we're doing it. That's the point.
Are we here to make this a better world?
Pardon?
We have an obligation to make it a better world than we
yes.
came in.
Yeah, yes and no. So the world's going to end. So in a way, who cares about global warming? I personally recycle carefully. because I believe Hashem's in charge of global warming. If the world's going to get warmer or not, that's totally in God's hands, not in my hands. However, I'm a citizen of the world, and I was charged with being responsible. So it's my personal spiritual avoda, my service, is to be careful with the resources that God has entrusted me with. Not because I think I'm going to prevent global warming, because that's the current understanding of what responsible is. And so I will be responsible as a spiritual striving to try to be careful. So yes, I'll try to make the world a better place because I want to transform myself. That's why. Transformation. So as Jews, all human beings, but particularly as Jews, we have a dual job. This is the job of the Jew. Transform yourself, transform the world. You transform yourself by transforming the world. You transform the world by transforming yourself. It's a reciprocal action. So you can't live in a cave. We can't be hermits, we Jews. We have to be in community. We have to be B'nai Yisrael. We are Jews together. Jews mean something different than B'nai Yisrael, Israelites. Israelites mean we live in community. So we live in community because it's only, we're not called the children of Abraham. One lone guy transformed the world's thinking, but he's one lone guy. We're not called the children of Isaac, one lone guy, right? We're called the children of Jacob because he had the 12. He created the critical mass that was necessary to transform the planet. You can't transform the planet alone. You have to have a group that can lead the way. That's our job. We're supposed to be planet transformers. Transform all of humanity, the entire planet, and do it by transforming ourselves. So transformation. So we're born with potential, and the job is to realize that potential. So, and to use the physical to do it. That's why we have a body. A soul can't do anything on its own. A disembodied soul is static. But the soul has to transform itself, so it needs a tool. That's why we have a body. That's why this whole world is here. The whole world is an arena for transformation, presenting us with choices everywhere we go.
Why are we born with temperaments?
So, it's an excellent question. Okay, I'll answer that question for you.
Here, there are four kids in my family.
Mm-hmm. Totally different.
One, yeah, they right. are completely different. I have a brother who is a hermit. Uh-huh. But he has certain limitations right. that keep him from being involved in the world.
Right.
Why? Why was he born like that?
Okay. So in the family, right, as children, did any one of you say, I want to be first, I brought that recipe first, I told that joke first, I was first to discover, people like
yeah,
to be first.
Usually my youngest brother right? would say that.
But it was a value. But it still was a value, right? We all want to be first. We want to be unique because we're created in the image of God, who's totally unique. So first of all, each one of us has to be totally unique because we're created in the image of God, who's totally unique. So there can't be that we're like anybody else on the planet. We have to be totally unique. That's number one. But number two is, once you're totally unique, then the connection that you make with God is totally unique. So you win the Nobel Prize for your connection because nobody else could make that connection. It's not possible. So you never have to vie with somebody else and say, well, my connection is better than your connection. Your connection can't be made by anybody. It's not possible. No relationship with God could be like your relationship with God. 100% unique. So you never have to be in competition with anybody. You win the prize of absolute 100% uniqueness in your efforts to create your connection.
But how do people become?
But people are born with limitations
yeah.
that make it very, very hard. For some people, it's easy. And for some people, it's very hard.
Well, so that's why, fortunately, God is the judge and not us. We're not even allowed to judge ourselves, actually. We think we can. We all know. We're all developed enough to know we shouldn't judge others. Not nice. We don't know what they went through, blah, 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 right? But we think, yes, I can judge myself. I know where I came from. I know what I can do. I know what I can achieve. And I know what a rat I am in certain things, right? So, no, you're not allowed to say that about yourself because you actually don't know what all the transgenerational stuff and how it manifests in your life and what all of that means. You know, the fact that I have a grandmother who almost finished a master's in chemistry working in the Merck lab along with my grandfather who had his master's in chemistry when they early got married and got the job to go work in plastics in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So So he got the job, of course, and she was the go along. No longer in the lab. Now her job was to have two kids, repress herself, and be the executive wife. She wanted to be in the Merck lab working on chemistry, but it was the 1930s. She had to be a good wife. So what does that repression that she had to exert on herself and the way she had to be that executive wife, how did that manifest in my father? And how did that manifest in me? Right? I don't know. So I can't judge myself necessarily if I'm a little bit emotionally cold to one of my children and say, you're so cold, you shouldn't be like that, you should be warmer. Well, I come from somebody who had worked so hard to repress herself that maybe it's still unfolding in the generation. So you think you can judge yourself, but you don't know if you can judge yourself. So you can't judge yourself. So that being said, God judges. We are not judged on where we're standing. It looks like, let's say there's a beauty pageant, right? Everybody's standing in a row and they're all judged right there compared to each other. We're not judged that way. We're judged at the distance that we cover. So wherever you come from, it's how far you go that you're judged on, not what you look like to others. So a person who's born with limitations, so somebody who has a terrible temper but's worked on making it into just a moderate temper, not a fabulous one, just moderate, that's huge. Compared to somebody who was born with no temper at all and never actually works on becoming more kind because they're plenty nice. Why should they work on themselves? They didn't achieve anything, really.
If you, maybe it's semantics, if you don't judge a trait to be less than what you want, where's the motivation to develop it to be something more?
You can do that. You can certainly have desires and striving, but you shouldn't judge yourself. You can judge a trait. You can set a goal. You can look at yourself with that goal. You should actually, especially if you're judging harshly, find somebody else to help you. You should have a friend or a mentor or a friend and a mentor. Sometimes we talk about a tripod of objectivity. So a mentor above you, a friend beside you, a student or a child below you can help you triangulate on yourself to see if you're actually setting an appropriate goal for yourself. Is that really something that you can achieve or not achieve? Should you be pushing yourself further or not? A self-discernment process, not judgment, is to see kind of where you're holding. Are you overwhelmed? You're doing too much, or you set too high a goal. Are you comfortable? You're not pushing yourself hard enough. Somewhere in between. It should be somewhere in between comfortable and overwhelmed. Right? So.
So how do we know that we don't choose to come back because we like it here?
Oh, like that's not our philosophy. So that's Kabbalah. What is Kabbalah? Kabbalah is the received tradition. It's not discerned tradition. There are traditions that are discerned. There is information that we discern from looking at the planet, science, and some Torah we discern from looking at the environment and extrapolating, but not Kabbalah. Kabbalah is handed over. It's not something you could know. So stuff about reincarnation, the next world, souls, how would you know that? How would you know that souls have five parts, and this is what we call them, and this is what an animal soul is, and this is what a human soul is, this is how it's connected. It's connected through the blood, and blah, blah, blah. All that stuff, how do you know that? Kabbalah. It's not like anybody can dissect a soul. Right? So that is Kabbalah. So how do we know we don't pick to come back? Kabbalah tells us. It's not comfortable to come back. Nobody wants to come back. They come back because they need to come back. All of us today are considered reincarnations. That's why we all have so much stuff. Because we all have stuff to deal with. Right? We all have things that we're trying to finish out. And there's, I want to end the conversation on souls, but there's a concept of personal soul, and to make it more complicated, there's family souls too. One reason why we look like our family members is because we do inherit some of their stuff. We inherit their physical stuff when they die, and we inherit their emotional stuff too. And that's so that we can sometimes use stuff to work on stuff. So, but we do often find that we're repeating generations, and we can stop generations from repeating themselves if we understand some of the mechanisms in there. But anyway, just ending this, so we are judged based on the distance that we traverse, not based on what we look like now. So I'll just give you one quick thing. I used to teach a class in Long Beach, and I regularly talked about not yelling at the kids. I had little kids then and was teaching people who had, I had medium kids and was teaching people who had littler kids. Not yelling at the kids, we need to be calm, blah, 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 right? So I'm thinking I'm pretty good at this. I'm a pretty calm mom. And I'm working on it too, also working on, but pretty, I'm achieving nicely and feeling kind of proud of myself about that. Meanwhile, I have a student in the class who's a misery in her house. Every time I go visit her, she's yelling, yelling, yelling. And I'm trying hard not to judge, but I am judging. I'm thinking, have you not listened to a single word I've been saying for the last year? You're like yelling like crazy. Your house is upside down. Your kids are in a panic over you. Like, I didn't say this to her, but I'm thinking this, right? And I just see her yelling and yelling and yelling all the time. I'm thinking, you are a yeller, right? So then I have my bubble burst because I go to a class on parenting, 100 young women, and you know, Rabbi Pelkowitz's son, Dr. Pelkowitz, is giving the class and says, you know, Jewish women, they yell a lot. They're like Mediterranean women. That's part of the Jewish woman's temperament, is that they're real yellers. And that's something that, you know, as women, he wasn't a woman, but you know, that we need to work on in our communities, less yelling. I'm thinking, yeah, that's really true. I really see that. We definitely need to do that. I'm thinking, I'm pretty good at not yelling that much. And then he says, you know, because that's a thing that Jewish women need to work on. And all of a sudden I realize, oh, I wasn't born Jewish. And I wasn't raised by a Jewish mother. That's why I'm good at not yelling. Not because I'm so fabulous and I've worked on it so much. Like, I didn't come from that challenge at all. So that burst my bubble. Meanwhile, I go and I watch this student that I have, and her mother comes to visit. And I had never met her mother before. Her mother was a maniac, screaming all the time. I mean, like, screaming. And then I realized, my student has accomplished so much that she's not like that. Oh my gosh, I thought she's a crazy yeller. And I see where she came from. She's amazing. The amount of progress she's made from where she came from is incredible. So I learned from that. It was one of my earlier experiences to not judge, not self, not others. You have to give a ton of space and you don't know. Okay, moving back to this. So a mitzvah is, so if we're in this world to transform ourselves, if we are spiritual beings inhabiting a physical body, so the question is, what do we do with this physical body, right? How do we transform our souls with our bodies? So the answer is mitzvahs. Mitzvahs are the way we use our body to transform our soul. So we have two separate groups of mitzvahs, do's and don'ts. Do's are grow your soul this way. Engage in this, and your soul will become developed. Don'ts are, look out for this soul diminishment zone. Don't do these things. They will diminish your soul, right?
What are the don'ts?
Don't eat pigs. Don't sleep around. Don't, you know, lots of don'ts. Don't worship idols. Don't kill people. Don't steal. Don't lie.
So it's way more than just the Ten Commandments.
Oh, yeah, we have 613 commandments and lots of small print. A ton of small print. Gobs and gobs, right?
Are the numbers of do's and don'ts equal, or are there more do's than don'ts?
There's more, let's see, it's 248 and 365, but I never remember which is which.
Wait, and how many do women have?
94. Women are exempt from positive time-bound commandments, which is only about 9 or 10 that we're exempt from.
What is that?
Positive time-bound commandments. Well, yeah, so praying in the exact time, women are exempt from that. Rosh Hashanah, you know, there's a new, very interested Russian young man who I met, and I was explaining different Jewish things to him, and he's like, he sees, like, I know a lot of stuff, and he's so excited, and he, you know, and then it's mincha time, somebody comes into the room, we're at the Aleski, and says, mincha, all the guys get up, right, time to go to shul. And he looks at me like, aren't you going to shul? I said, it's mincha, it's kind of a guy thing. And he said, a guy thing? He said, oh yeah, I noticed there's like this curtain there that divides between the men and the women. What is that about? I said, oh, that's there so that the men won't be jealous when they look over and see that the women's section is empty because the women don't have to go. Looked at me and he said, really?
That's good.
Okay. So, mitzvot are the physical pathways to a spiritual goal. Okay, that's the definition. How you use your body to accomplish something spiritual. Now, there's a mitzvah called mitzvat ona, the mitzvah of sexual relations. It's called the mitzvah of ona. Who knows what ona means? Enough Hebrew for that? La'anot. La'anot is to answer. It's a mitzvah of answering. It also means season. And here it's a mitzvah of answering. Who in this mitzvah is being answered?
God.
How is God being answered?
Because
in the mitzvah of marital relations.
But isn't it sort of a... It is
a together thing, which we'll talk about in a second.
Which includes God.
It's his commandment to do it. So the mitzvah has a name. Right, it is a mitzvah to be one, but it's a mitzvah of answering. So the person that's being answered in this mitzvah is the woman. It is the man's obligation to sexually satisfy his wife. And it says that in the ketubah. The ketubah, the marriage document, it's read in Aramaic so that nobody will be embarrassed, but it's read under the chuppah out loud, where he says he enters into a contractual obligation to her. It's his obligation to her. There's nothing in the ketubah about her obligations to him. It's his obligations to her. He makes the promise. I promise. I will feed you, house you, clothe you, and sexually satisfy you. That's my obligation to you. So she is the one who's being answered. The Torah understands, God understands, that in his quest to please her, he will also be pleased. But it's not always the other way around, right? A woman often doesn't have pleasure if she is focusing on pleasuring him. So it's her job basically to receive, not that she can't be an active participant, but it's her job to receive, it's not his job to receive, it's her job to receive. Again, the woman can be totally involved and active, but it's his job to pleasure her, and he will get pleasure thereby.
So this is a pretty sophisticated discussion when you have... No, seriously. It's like my cousin's married. They're both juniors at YU. Mm-hmm. She's at Stern, and I was at their wedding. They're both 20 and 21 years old, and she looked like a deer in the headlights going down the aisle, you know?
Right.
How do you teach a guy... who has never touched a woman, never kissed a woman.
Right.
I mean, they're kept very separate.
Right.
Even at the wedding, you can't even sit at the same table anymore.
Right.
They have so many
new
rules.
Right. Sure.
So there's the comfort level is completely, I mean, I asked the rabbis, I said...
It's very uncomfortable at first.
I said, you're making it so difficult for them to even have like a normal dating scenario.
Right.
So how does a guy and a girl even know...
Right. First of all, it turns out they figured it out really quick. But second of all,
no,
it does turn out...
I'm talking about the man pleasuring.
Right. He's taught. He's supposed to be taught. Yes.
Really?
So they have what's called chasen classes and kala classes. Many of them are not good. Some of them are very good. So the chasen, usually the groom, gets just a schmooze. He doesn't have to learn halacha. She has to learn quite a bit. Because in order to keep the laws of Torah to Mishpacha, there's a lot of law to learn. So she usually has 6 to 12 sessions. Usually 4-ish are on the law, how to keep the law. And then why 6 to 12? It's because you might have also marriage classes. And today, they too try to make it longer. Communication and arguing and working things out, expressing yourself, understanding what control is and how to avoid control and abuse, understanding abuse and how to protect yourself from it, that kind of stuff. In a good kala class is taught. And the last class, called the Shir Acharon, the last class is about sex. She will be shown anatomy pictures. She will be taught what a clitoris is. She will be taught what pleasure is. She will be taught what an orgasm is. And he should be too, hopefully in a good class. He's only taught that right at the end because he has a problem of seminal emission. You don't want him to learn too far before because, first of all, you don't want him to be too nervous. And second of all, you don't want him thinking about it too much before the wedding. So it's usually the night before the wedding.
You don't think he's thinking about it already?
He is thinking about it already, but you don't want to give him extra reasons to be thinking about it. Because you're teaching him straight up. A good chassan teacher is actually teaching where the erogenous zones are and where and how to kiss and what to talk about and like how to... You don't want to teach too much because you want it to be a personal, private exploration, and you don't want to be thinking about the Rebbe who taught you how to do this when you're doing it.
Your brother teaching your sister?
Sometimes you do learn some stuff from that, but so there is conversation.
The brother teaching the brother,
right?
The sister teaching the sister.
Yeah, or parent teaching child sometimes.
Is that okay?
Yes, but it is. But sometimes communication is not so good, and sometimes there's not as thorough a knowledge. Yeah, so it turns out that many are very nervous. Because if you've been that separate, you haven't ever touched, and now you're not just going to touch, but you know what you're going to do that night.
And everybody else.
And you know everybody else knows what you're going to do. It's the most embarrassing thing, right? So, like, it is extremely uncomfortable. It is, at first. I didn't even really appreciate that until I raised Basyakov's daughters, married them off, and then, like, as they're getting married, like, hear that freak out phase, you know, like they didn't have the background, you know, so yeah, but they do figure it out quickly and hopefully. Now, some people have bad teachers and so they don't figure it out so well, and when I give talks like this in some firm communities, sometimes people will come to me or call me anonymously just to ask questions that they never had answered, or I say things straight out, some things straight out, which still have to get to before hopefully Rabbi Liebman's not here yet. I know. Well, I'm going to get to... So, let me get to one more piece here just before he kicks me out, and then if we can do a third session, great, that's fine, I'll be happy to do it. But, okay, so here's the concept, okay? The mitzvah of Ona is a mitzvah. She's being answered, so we talked about that. It's his job to make sure that she is sexually pleasured, okay? Sexually satisfied in the relationship altogether. He has to sexually satisfy her. So now, but it's still a mitzvah. So if a mitzvah is a physical pathway to a spiritual goal, what spiritual goal is being accomplished by this physical act? The knitting of the soul halves together. Right? You have your two soul halves, and now you're supposed to become one flesh, but your soul halves have to become one too. So, but you can't just make two soul halves stick. You have to do something physical, because the physical is the way to accomplish the spiritual. So you have to do something physical to make the spiritual happen. So the mitzvah of marital relations is the pathway through which the soul becomes united. Slowly, over time. It takes time. But you're united, heart, soul, mind, body, there is supposed to be complete contact in all those realms. Complete body contact, no clothes, nothing in between. In general, not always, but in general, it's recommended no lights, because lights seem to come in between two people. Could be self-conscious or whatever. So lights off, clothes off, and no anger that comes in between two. No drunkenness. Tipsy is different, but no drunkenness. Nothing that comes in between you and the other person bonding. No thoughts of divorce, no thoughts of affairs, no thoughts of fantasizing about other people, right? Nothing that comes in between the two of you. It's all supposed to be bonding, emotionally, physically, supposed to be bonding and pleasureful, giving to each other. It's mutual giving. So that's the mitzvah, and the mitzvah actually is reminiscent. It's actually a taste of the world to come. So we talked about the world to come a little bit. Did I tell you my Hadassah lady joke?
No.
All right, so who's the Hadassah lady? I am. So I'm telling a joke about the Hadassah lady. So there's 30 Hadassah ladies on the bus. And they're driving along on a tour in Israel, and the bus goes off a cliff, and they all die. But they're Hadassah ladies, so straight up to heaven they go, right? They knock on the pearly gates, and the angel comes and says, hello. And they say, hello, we're the Hadassah ladies, we're here. And the angel says, sorry, I don't see you on the list. And they say, what do you mean we're not on the list? We're the Hadassah ladies. Of course we're on the list. And the angel says, I'm really sorry, I'm checking the list. I don't see you. So you're going to have to go downstairs. They say, what? That's it? You're not on the list? Down you go. So down they go, right? 5 minutes later, the front desk angel gets a buzz from God. New, we're the Hadassah ladies. And the angel says, what? What do you mean? He says, I'm expecting a busload of 30 Hadassah ladies. Have they arrived yet? He says, well, they arrived, but they weren't on the list. So he says, what do you mean they weren't on the list? You didn't get the revised list? He says, no, I didn't get a revised list. He says, well, where are they? He said, well, I sent them downstairs. God said, what do you mean you sent them downstairs? They're Hadassah ladies. They for sure belong here. He says, call right now. Call downstairs and get them back. So the angel picks up the phone and he calls the devil and he says, you know the busload of 30 Hadassah ladies? Well, I need them back. And the devil says, no way. They've been here for less than 24 hours and already they've raised enough for air conditioning. So, do we believe in heaven and hell? That's why I tell the joke. We tell lots of jokes with heaven and hell in it. No, the answer is no, we don't. But we do believe in a next world. But we don't believe in a dichotomy of worlds. What is the next world? We talk about parables of heaven and hell. But there's no such place. There can't be a place at all because you're not physical. You're spiritual. So what is the next world? The next world is where you live in the relationship that you have with Hashem. That's what it is. So for my next quick parable, imagine you're on a cruise, right? You and your spouse. Whether you have a spouse or not, right? Whether you're divorced or married, you and your spouse, you and, or let's just imagine a spouse if you don't have one and you never had one, so imagine that spouse. You and your spouse are on the cruise. This particular cruise, there's nobody else on it except for people to take care of you, right? So there is no entertainment. There is no, there's meals. They clean up after you, right? And there's a library. There's games. You can play games. You can go to the library. You can swim in the pool. But there's no other people to talk to. There's not. It's just you and your spouse. And it's 3 weeks. All your obligations are completely taken care of. So there's no worry about what you left behind on shore. But you're 3 weeks alone on this boat with your spouse. If you have a good relationship, you're in heaven. How great is it to have 3 weeks alone with nothing to do, no meals to prepare, nothing to clean up, no housekeeping, no errands to run, no obligations, no work, no nothing, no distractions, just you and your spouse. It's fabulous. But if you have a bad relationship, you are in hell because it's 3 weeks alone with this person and no distractions, no meals to prepare, no errands to run, no carpool, no cleanup, no work, no obligations, nothing to take you away from this person, nothing. It's just you and that person alone for 3 weeks. So you could see that the quality of the experience is directly dependent on the quality of the relationship. That's what Olam Haba is. The next world is heaven or hell, depending on your relationship. He's here, right? Depending on your relationship. So it really is supposed to be a world of all pleasure. And it's a whole long conversation how you get to take out all the negative that you have done, everybody's done negative, and remove that so that you live in only pleasure, only the amount of pleasure that you earned, but only pleasure. And that's what the next world is. Okay, let's leave that aside for a second. So this world is the world of working on. That's the world of living in. You can't accomplish anything in the next world. Just like on that cruise boat. They didn't load it. It's not there. Right? The next world.
So what do you do up there?
The next world, if you didn't load it, it's not there. You live. It's hard to explain because it's not physical. So you're not bored of living in this relationship. You're basking in the glow of the Shekhinah, whatever that means. It is imbibing pleasure. You're living in pleasure. You're dwelling in the pleasure. Not working towards, you're dwelling in. So if we're all Olam Haba bound, I should tell him, I have to go for another 5 minutes. I'm just going to tell him.
Sorry. I don't want to be disrespectful to him.
Make a list.
Of course you do. She's not out there. Okay. If we're all Olam Haba bound, then there must be a way to practice in this world. Because it wouldn't really be fair to just have us die, cut us off from effort, and then we just drift and dwell, right? So we have a practice in this world of working towards and dwelling in. What is that practice called? Shabbos. 6 days of the week you work towards. 1 day of the week you dwell in. If you didn't try to accomplish it before Shabbos, you can't do it on Shabbos. Shabbos is the dwell-in day. And then, let's say you didn't like that Shabbos experience, you could try it again next week. 6 days of working towards, 1 day of dwelling in. That's why Shabbos is considered a taste of the next world. Not just because the food is yummy and the clothes are pretty and the house is clean and whatever you've done. It's not because the next world is not a place that's pleasant. It's the next world is dwelling in pleasantness. So you dwell in whatever you created. However much energy you put into Shabbos, That's what you get. That's the Shabbos that you experience. So you work towards, dwell in. Work towards, dwell in. It's a taste of the next world in terms of dwelling. And so is the sexual experience. The sexual experience is made of working towards. You have foreplay and energy going towards a goal of total pleasure where you dwell in pleasure. When you achieve that sexual climax, there is no place else to go and nothing else to do for the amount of time that you're there in the moment, totally in pleasure. It's a taste of the next world because it is dwelling in pleasure. That's why all human beings are driven towards a sexual experience, because it is a taste in this world of the next world. That's what we want. We're all grasping for that pleasure. But the question is, what kind of pleasure are we grasping towards? So a sexual relationship in marriage is the holiest activity it's possible to do. Holier than prayer, holier than temple service, holier than sacrifices, holier than tzedakah, holier than feeding the poor, clothing the needy, etc., etc. It's the holiest act because it combines everything we've been talking about. It is becoming godly. It's emulating God in that you're using your free will to be a giver to another, to create one, to become a union, to unite. And when you unite and emulate God in God's oneness through the giving aspect, then you bring the Shekhinah into the world. Then you actually channel God's presence into the world. In the Kadosh Kadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, above the ark, there's two cherubs. They have a male face and a female face. We learn in Sunday school or in elementary school that when God is happy with the Jews, they face each other. And when God is not happy with the Jews, they turn back to back. But actually, they're hidden behind a curtain in the Holy of Holies, so nobody can see them because it's private. Because when God is happy with the Jews, they're actually locked in romantic embrace. And when God is not happy, then they're back to back. But they're actually coupling in there. So the Holy of Holies is called the bedroom of the temple. And our marital bedrooms are called the Holy of Holies of our homes. Because it's not a euphemism. It's in that room that the holiest act takes place. And it's through that act of unity and mutual giving of pleasure, giving to each other, and emulating God by giving and creating oneness, that we actually bring God's presence into the world. That's what creates shalom, shleimut, because we're halves. And when we come together and make a whole, we've created shalem. That's a root, right? One of the spokes is shalom, peace. But shalom has to do with shalem, wholeness. We've created wholeness. And God is whole. And so that attracts God in, and from there spreads God out into the whole world. So if anybody wants to affect positively the world, affect Darfur, affect Iraq, affect the Palestinian situation, having a strong, powerful, passionate, kosher sexual relationship with your spouse is a way to bring God's presence into the world and bring peace into the world. From your private, and it's all supposed to be done in private, it's not a secret that you do it, but it's private when you do it. From the privacy of your bedroom, you create shalom in the world. And that's why the practice that holds that, the halachic process that holds that, is called taharat hamishpacha, family purity. I don't like the word purity, it's a bad translation, but we can't go into it now because I have to give him the class. Right? It's not called female purity, and it's not called couple purity. It's called family purity, that act and that whole body of halacha, because the whole family lives inside the shalom that's created by the couple. So, that being said, I'm going to have to drop you off right here. Understanding what the sexual relationship is in Judaism, it's extremely holy, not something to be avoided at all. Oh, one more thing I'll tell you. It's supposed to be, when it's kosher, at the right time, which is a whole different class, at least twice a week. That's considered maintenance. So there's a story of an elderly gentleman who goes to his rabbi and says, you know, Rabbi, I'm old, I'm tired, and twice a week, it's a lot. I just discussed it with my wife, and she said, you know, maybe we could stop doing this mitzvah. Could I have permission to stop doing this mitzvah now? So the rabbi said, and he said, you know, my wife said it's okay. So the rabbi said, well, If your wife says it's okay, then you probably never properly fulfilled the mitzvah in the first place. So it is supposed to be something that's enlivening and gives and brings a life to the relationship and creates a bonding. It doesn't have to be twice a week. If you're older and tired, the woman should be satisfied. So he should check in with her. Are you feeling like you're getting enough? And she should also check in with him. She should keep him happy too. But it's his responsibility and it's her kindness to keep each other happy. So that's it. You can ask questions if you want, but I think it'll have to be another time.